Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. It is Players Championship Week. It is Wednesday afternoon. All the preparations have essentially been done for this week at the PGA Tour's flagship event. And Rex, we just bumped into PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan in a little bit different mood than what we saw him on Tuesday at TPC Sawgrass, where he was under siege for about an hour for the media. The first time he has met the media, Jay Monahan has, since the Tour Championship last August. Let's start there. That's the newsiest part of his Players Championship Week so far. What stood out to you from Jay Monahan's press conference?
What stood out is I just made the commissioner laugh, which I feel like that should stand for something given what he's been through over the last few weeks. He was walking by the media center, and the new to the Players Championship this year is something called the PGA Tour Recovery Center. It's just off here to my left. And John McGinnis, the former PGA Tour player, was looking out of the Sirius XM tent where he had just got through doing an interview. And John said, I wish they had the recovery center when I was playing on the tour. And without thinking, I said, that's not the kind of recovery center that John McGinnis needed. And I think if anybody knows John, you know exactly what I'm saying. Got a chuckle out of the commissioner. So I feel like that my week is off to a good start, because his was not. It was Tuesday. It lasted 57 minutes and it was tough. And we just got through talking with him about it. I mean, he's in a very unenviable position in the middle of very, very delicate, very, very complicated, very, very nuanced negotiations with Saudi Arabia's public investment fund. And suddenly he's put in front of the spotlight and he's expected to have answers in twofold. One, he doesn't really have any answers. There's obviously no deal. I didn't get the impression they were even close to a deal. And two, even if he did start spouting off opinions, it was only going to hurt the negotiations. You're better off not saying anything at all. I think we could read between the lines a little bit, but for a guy that clearly had his hands tied, like there was nothing he could say. We had to ask the questions and he had to not answer them. There was a couple of nuggets in there that I think we can sort of dissect and get into a little bit. By and large, it was very underwhelming, which is what we should have expected.
Yeah, underwhelming, unsatisfied. That's sort of the takeaway that I had. He did say that, you know, when he next sees us, presumably at the Tour Championship in August at East Lake, they should have made more significant progress as it relates to the deal with the Saudi Public Investment Fund. Read between that what you will. That's 5 months from now. He called the talks accelerating. Whether that's going 100 miles an hour, whether that's going 0.5 miles an hour, it certainly seems like the latter in that respect. I'm with you, Rex. I didn't necessarily expect him to delve into some of the, quote, several key issues that he does have as the PGA Tour is trying to negotiate this deal with the PIF. I thought he'd be slightly more forthcoming, whether it was about the team plan, how to integrate that, whether it was talking about a live pathway back. What are some of the specific holdups to this deal? Because I think everyone, talking to players, us in the media, listening to fans, there's fatigue on the front of it. It just feels like we're going through the same cycle over and over again. And you're going through that same cycle because there has been no progress. There has been no update, at least publicly, on what's happening. That's frustrating for folks like us, but I certainly assume that it's frustrating for players as well to be left in the dark. When you think about June 6th and kind of the blowback of kind of that secret deal, they wanted more transparency and more openness from PGA Tour leadership. Well, they can't. Right now, their hands are tied for what they can do just because they're signing the NDAs as they discuss this. And that's sort of unsatisfying, I think, for everyone at every level. Jay understands that, but that was certainly kind of my takeaway from the press conference as well.
And I think those are the two big takeaways that you just touched on. Two of the, let's call them flashpoints in the negotiations, are going to be what the path back looks like if there is some sort of deal for the players who join LIV. And how would you, in a perfect best case scenario, work team golf into whatever, let's use Rory's word, a global schedule is going to look like, because I think we all feel like that's the way things are heading. And there was one takeaway that he mentioned when he was specifically asked about how in the world could the players who left be allowed back, because that's going to be really, really tough, because there's a lot of strong opinions on both sides of this. And he said there's going to be people who are disappointed on both sides. Like there's probably going to be people on LIV who either won't be allowed back or don't like the pathway and will just probably walk away. There's going to be people on the PGA Tour who feels like it's too easy, that these players walked away, got paid, and now they're going to be allowed to come back. It's never going to be an easy solution. My guess is this is one of the main things holding up these negotiations, because as we talked about before, signing with SSG, and I've kind of come to this conclusion on Tuesday coming out of the press conference, because Jay Monahan was asked specifically if the SSG deal, which is led by Fenway Sports private equity, if that actually hurts a potential deal with PIF. And I walked away from that answer thinking we used to kind of be under the mindset that it could have been SSG or, in italics, PIF. I think it's SSG and PIF. I think those two come together, because what that deal did, first and foremost, that set the market. If it's going to be a $12 billion valuation, which essentially is what it's going to be, and they made an initial $1.5 billion investment, now we have an idea of what a minority investor would look like. The numbers are set. You have an idea where to start from. It's also going to make any potential deal with the PIF a little bit easier for the tour to sell to federal regulators, because the Department of Justice and U.S. senators have made it clear they're not comfortable with this. So you're going to have to sell them on the idea that, yes, the PIF is investing in this American institution, but they're doing it on a minority level, that they won't have the ultimate say in what happens. And that's going to be a tough hurdle. I mean, I think people sort of dismiss that because of where we're at right now in the negotiations, but that's going to be a big part of it.
I think if you look at SSG specifically, and I mean, these are powerhouse names in professional sports leagues, whether it's Arthur Blank, whether it's Steve Cohen, John Henry of the Red Sox. These are people who are also interested in pursuing Saudi cash. I mean, this is a potential gold mine, and potentially interacting with them in the future, bringing them into the fold, I think was something that's very attractive. It's a reason why SSG representatives were with the PGA Tour when they met with the Saudis earlier this year. But I do understand the point that now having SSG could make a potential deal a little bit more palatable for regulators. But I also think last fall, Rex, there could have been a conclusion drawn that it actually hurt the negotiations with the Saudis as well, courting private equity on their own, potentially as a backup option if that deal with the Saudis does go through. We saw what happened on December 7th. That date is underlined in PGA Tour history because, A, that was the day that they unanimously voted to go ahead with SSG and this private investor. But that was also the day that John Rahm announced, perhaps coincidentally, that he was going to be leaving for LIV Golf. So I think two things can be true at the same time.
And I would look back on that day and say both sides were playing the negotiation game. Like, both sides were trying to get leverage. John Rahm was a great signing, but he was certainly leverage in the negotiations. SSG was clearly leverage. I mean, and I think that's what you do. I'm not a business person, but my guess is you don't take that personal. I mean, you're in this. It's a competition.
You don't think John Rahm in the rumored signing of $300 to $600 million was personal? You don't think nabbing the player who probably should have been the PGA Tour Player of the Year was personal? You don't think securing services of the reigning Masters champion was
I think personal? Tiger Woods. No, I think to Tiger Woods, certainly John Rahm was personal by all accounts. And I think to a lot of players, that was personal. It should not be to Jay Monahan and the rest of the people on the PGA Tour side who are doing the negotiating, just like SSG is not and should not be personal to the public investment fund and those who are representing them. My understanding is this is just business. You and I are going to look like, and oh man, they're throwing punches at each other. This is the way the world of business works. I don't think it was personal. I think this is just the way they were trying to, it's a chess game, and they're just trying to position the pieces in the best way they possibly can. And I do want to circle back real quick, and you're right. PIF probably does want to be in business with the John Henrys and the Cohens of the world and the Arthur Blanks of the world. My guess is the Arthur Blanks and the John Henrys also want to be in business with the Saudis. So this is a good relationship. It's a good business deal for everyone involved if they can just get it done.
And just to be clear, Jay Monahan said on a couple of occasions that negotiating a deal, eventual deal with the PIF is the, quote, best outcome for the PGA Tour. And he stressed over and over again that unification of the game and all of the myriad layers that entails is in the best interest of the PGA Tour long term as you look toward its future, specifically with the for-profit entity with PGA Tour Enterprises. Rex, what else stood out to you, if anything, from the 57 minutes with the commissioner?
I felt like even though he didn't have any answers, and this went back to the idea, this goes back to the idea that the last time we spoke to him was at the Tour Championship last year. And I felt, I don't want to say combative, but the commissioner was clearly uncomfortable with some of the questions he was having to field. He was clearly not in the best mind space because of what had happened. And keep in mind, right after June 6th, he had to take an extended leave for personal time because of some problems he was dealing with himself. And he talked a little bit about it there. This time seemed a little bit more fluid. This time, I think he projected a little bit more of leadership, which is kind of what he had to do. Because in the aftermath of yesterday's press conference, every player who's marched into the media center here at TPC Sawgrass, and certainly every player that a media type has run across, has been asked, is Jay Monahan the right person for the job, or some variation of that question? And it's really important for him at this stage to project the idea that, yes, I am the right person for that job. And I think he did a better job this time around than he certainly did last year at East Lake.
I would agree with that, saying he knows in his heart that he's the right person for the job, and also the responsibilities that both boards, on both the PGA Tour Policy Board as well as the new board of directors that was just announced with PGA Tour Enterprises, has put him in a position as CEO to express that they clearly have faith in Jay Monahan. All right, Rex, several players, as you mentioned, have gone inside the media tent. One player who did not was Rory McIlroy. He dragged us lowly scribes out at 7:50 a.m. Sun was just coming out here at TPC Sawgrass to meet with the media, fielded a number of questions from how to play the 17th hole to kind of the future with the PGA Tour and the fans to the current state of his game. How do you assess Rory's chances, as now we're less than a month to the Masters, and that's now three consecutive starts in the PGA Tour for Rory while finishing outside the top 30?
I kind of put him 1B right behind Scottie Scheffler, who should be 1A. And that's probably a little too high. I'm probably being overly optimistic. I feel like what we saw last week off the tee is Rory. I mean, he was second in the field, only behind Scottie, and strokes gained off the tee. And that anytime he can do that, the rest of his game flows. Now, it hasn't done that in the last few weeks. And we talked about it today on Live From when you and I were talking about Rory, the idea that he needs two separate swings, the driver swing, the three-wood swing. It feels fantastic. But his irons are just going left. They start left, and they keep going left. And you and I both are well aware that that is no way to play golf.
Left going left.
Especially on this, and especially on this golf course. And so he needs to find some sort of fix. It's someone I talked to someone in his camp today that said he kind of broke it down very, very scientifically. And the way it essentially works out is he is 2 degrees out, which means he's inside out, which means it's a draw swing with his driver, but he's hitting up on his driver. It's pretty much level with his three wood. That works. Where it doesn't work is when he's 3 degrees out, he's got that draw swing and his club face is 1.5 degrees shut, 1 degree shut, whatever the case may be. Because you're descending, you're hitting down on the ball, it doesn't work. And the way this person described it to me is you have to have two separate swings. And that kind of surprised you this afternoon when I hit you with it, when you rolled your eyes and like, I like to have just one swing. I'm kind of with you. But with Rory, I think what he needs to do is kind of start being a little bit more neutral with his irons. And this person told me that he played a practice round yesterday and felt like he hit the irons the way he wanted to. Still have to see it. And I will point to last week. And we all saw the video footage of him working with Brad Faxon on Thursday night, late into the evening, trying to fix his putting. He lost 3.5 strokes on Thursday on the greens at Bay Hill, and he gained 3 strokes on Friday. So he has it in him to turn these types of things around. I have to see it. It's why he's 1B, but it may be a little too optimistic.
Yeah, I think 1B is probably a little bit too generous as it relates to Rory McIlroy. We have seen the left miss pop up at certain times this year. It cost him a tournament in Dubai. He could have gone back-to-back in Dubai if not for a left miss in the 72nd hole. We saw what happened at the Cognizant where there's trouble everywhere to be had, and he was struggling there. Bay Hill, we saw him kind of mutilate a tee marker, boiling over with frustration. Now he still shot 30 on the back nine. So the good is still plenty good. But as you look to TPC Sawgrass, certainly as you look ahead to Augusta National in just 4 weeks' time, the precision has to be there with the iron play. The targets are so small, and the margin of errors, specifically on these two tests, is just razor thin. And it's just so penal. Both of these examinations in particular, I know he's playing the Valero Texas Open where you're going to be as well, but these two courses in particular, if you do miss, the punishment is just so high. So I'm very curious to see how he plays. He's certainly, I think, the most interesting player to watch this week, but I would put a Max Homa, a Hideki Matsuyama, certainly a Justin Thomas, who just might be my pick to win this week, a Will Zalatoris
ahead of Scotty. Really?
I'm saying ahead of Rory McIlroy in terms of the list of favorites. I think Scottie Scheffler is obviously the clear 1A, and that's kind of where I wanted to take this conversation. Now, you covered him last week at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. He's the defending champion here. No player in this tournament's history has successfully defended his title. Make the case for why Scotty can do it and also why he can't.
Why he can do it is easy. We had said all along that
he good.
If we just putts average, he's going to win more times than not. If he picks up 4.5 strokes on the field, he's going to win by 5 strokes. And that's what we saw at Bay Hill. Now, that was one day. And, of course, you want to see a larger body of work. What we don't need to see a larger body of work is off the tee. And with his irons, he doesn't have any of those problems that we just talked about in length of Rory McIlroy. He is such a sublime ball striker, and he seems to only be getting better. I thought it was fascinating hearing him sort of talk about the process of what happens when, if and when, we have never really seen it, but what happens when things start going wrong and how simple he keeps it. You and I had a chance to catch up with the swing coach, Randy Smith. He hasn't been on tour since actually last Masters was his last time he was on the PGA Tour. He'd had some health issues, and it's all simple stuff. It's never complicated. Like it, I'd love having a chance to sit down and talk with the Sean Fullers of the world who really break the swing down in an interesting way. And I do find that interesting, the golf nerd in me. Randy Smith is not that. Is your grip right? Is your alignment right? Do you feel like your setup is good? Is your posture good? Then swing the golf club. And that's as simple as it seems to be. And I'm sure we're oversimplifying this, but I think that's the heart of what makes him real good, like you just said, is there aren't any complicated thoughts in there. He knows he's got a very, very good swing. He knows he can do it if all of those basic pieces are in place.
Yeah, and you know, if he's not first overall in strokes gained tee to green this week, he's going to certainly be in the top five. The golf course is still soft. We had a bunch of rain over the weekend. It's going to be very gettable. The winning score is going to be somewhere between 13 and 18 under par, and Scottie Scheffler is certainly going to get his. I think, Rex, there's going to be so much attention still paid to his putter. For those of us wondering, and certainly the commentators on television wondering, was last week an aberration, or are the changes that he's undergone with putting guru Phil Kenyon finally starting to pay dividends? Was the putter switch to a mallet, and was the decision to go away from kind of lining up the line on his golf ball instead just relying on the line on his putter, is that going to make all the difference? Will, if he starts to miss a couple putts early in his rounds here at the Players Championship, will some more doubt start to creep in of, am I rolling as good as I thought I was? Am I on the right path here? You know, he has a very small sample size of performing well on the greens this year. I mean, it was an incredible sample size. Do not get me wrong. He made 23 consecutive putts inside 15 feet, and he blew away the field, a stacked field at Bay Hill. But at this point, it's still a very small sample size, and it does appear at this point to be an anomaly compared to how he's played the rest of the season. So I think there's going to be so much attention paid to it, and I'm very curious to see how he responds if and when the putts do stop falling. Anything else as it relates to Scotty, yeah, and why you don't think he can do it?
No, I'm not going to go with why I don't think he can do it, because I think he'd be foolish at this point in time to make that argument, simply because he's defending champ and what he did last week. Like, those are the two most what have you done for me lately things to do, and it's a very sports radio thing to do. But he's still the best ball striker on tour, and maybe he doesn't have the putting week he had on Sunday. Again, if he's zero across the board in strokes game putting, I still really like his chances, because if he putts average,
just be average.
I will say this to your point about Sunday was great, but when you talk to him on after the round, it wasn't Sunday when whatever worked well on Sunday that he kept going back to. It was Thursday when things really didn't work, and he lost strokes to the field, and he shot a 70. He didn't feel comfortable with what he did. He felt like he and Teddy, his caddy, talked after the round, like, look, man, I'm not going to get caught up in the score. Like, the process was good. He felt like he hit good putts. It felt like he was doing all the things he wanted to do. If he stays in that mindset and does what we talked about on Sunday night, if he tries not to, if he can allow himself not to be perfect, I still really like his chances.
And there was a moment, I think it was in the third round, on the 11th hole, where he kind of berated himself for a miss, and that sort of ignited him. He sort of checked back in and putted sublime the rest of the tournament. And so it will be interesting to watch. There's no doubt that is going to be one of the biggest storylines here at TPC Sawgrass. Rex, what would you say to those who say this tournament has been diminished by all of the lived affections? It's no longer the strongest field in golf, that that the PGA Tour's flagship event has been severely harmed by what's been going on in the sport in the civil war over the last couple of years.
And we were just on with Jason Sobel on Sirius XM, and he asked us essentially that question. And you and I looked at each other kind of terrified, because it's a very delicate question in these parts. You and I both are sitting here at TPC Sawgrass. We're actually about 10 feet from each other.
So this thing bugged. This thing bugged.
That's right. And he's right behind me. He's in that window. If he opens it up, you can probably see. Yep, that's where he is. Just to open up the curtain there a little bit to show people. Yes, of course it is. And this sparks from the conversation you and I had right before we went on live from this afternoon when you broke our microphone. Please go check that out. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Jared.
To sort of bounce around. Yeah, thanks, Jared. Appreciate your help on that front. And the idea was, I think it was Steve Borkowski who said something about, well, the world ranking strength of the field is XYZ. And I was real quick to dismiss him. And I have no ill will towards the official world golf ranking. It's not a legitimate number anymore. I think that's the fairest way to say this. Like, you look at the world golf ranking, and look, we can all agree Scottie Scheffler is number one and Rory McIlroy is number two. Yep, you're not going to get any argument from me. It's as we go further down the list, who should really be in the top 100? Who should really be in the top 50? It doesn't work anymore, because those players who we know are still good, just because they joined LIV Golf, they didn't fall out of the top 100 in the world. The math said they did, but they're still top 100 players in the world. So you can't make a fair assessment on exactly what this field is. Of course, it's not as strong as it was last year, nor last year wasn't as strong as it was the year before.
But does it feel different? You've covered this tournament for two plus decades. Does it feel as grand? Does it feel as important without a Rahm, without a Brooks, without a Bryson, without a DJ, without a Cam Smith, who just won this tournament just a couple years ago?
Yes. I think if you walked around property, and you and I have a couple times so far, I think as we get closer to Saturday, which coincides with St. Patrick's Day, I think we both agree that this place is going to be a zoo. It's not going to be Scottsdale, but it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be what Rory talked about today. And that's a really good comparison. And I have been to a Formula One race, and it is an event. And that's what they have created there. There's a bunch of things around the golf course that are different this year. You and I were just talking with the commissioner, and all of them are small and subtle. It feels very Augusta-ish, where every year they're trying to tweak something a little bit better. The actual feeling on property, in my opinion, is not impacted by that statement that, oh, it's the deepest field or the best field in golf, however we want to phrase that. This is still an event. You live here. You're a Nocatee. I mean, Knocklife. Like, you tell me, how many tickets have you had to round up this week? It's a big event.
Too exactly. Many. And I think the star of this tournament is not necessarily the field. And forever, like, they boast that this is the strongest field in golf. The star of this tournament is the golf course. There is no doubt that this is the best stadium in all of golf. It is my favorite tournament non-Ryder Cup years of the year, because you know the back nine is going to produce drama. It doesn't matter whether it's Webb Simpson in a runaway. It doesn't matter whether it's Cam Smith trying to hold on for dear life just a couple years ago. It always delivers some sort of drama and some sort of tension. I don't think the characters involved actually matter. I think it's whether or not the golf course produces the kind of drama, and it almost always does. Without fail, it almost always does that. And so that's kind of where I fall on that. As it relates to the strongest, the best, the deepest, whatever you want to do, I do think there is some semantics involved here. I don't think this is a cop-out either. This is the deepest field of the PGA Tour season. Is it the best field, or is it the strongest field of the PGA Tour season? I would actually say no. I actually think the signature events
are stronger
from top to bottom.
And I had to correct you on this on Sobel's show. You say the deepest field of the PGA Tour season outside of the majors. Let's put that caveat on there. Like, I
PGA Tour regular season. PGA Tour regular season.
Okay. Now you're comparing FedEx Cup playoffs. Like, now you're getting weird. I'm just saying outside of the majors. And look, you can sit here and pick apart the PGA Championship, because they do have the club pros in the field, and that does.
But you could pick apart all of them. You could pick out the Masters and the past champions. You could pick out the Open qualifiers or the players who have been qualifying for the past 9 months for the Open Championship, or golf's longest day for the U.S. Open. Like, you could nitpick with all of them. The PGA Championship, though, is the closest safe the club pros at the bottom of the field. You can make the same argument for the Players Championship and the bottom of this field. Now, I think those two are pretty equitable in terms of field strength.
Well, and this is going to go to, so you asked me two separate questions. One, what does it feel like on property? I feel like there's a really good buzz on property. Again, if you live in Jacksonville, if you live in Nocatee, if you're in this area, this is a big event. My goddaughter lives here and I had to round up tickets. Like they look forward to coming here and doing this. And this is not a small market. They have an NFL football team. So it means something to
go
be
Jags.
Here.
Duval.
Duval. I think the other side of this equation is, and we'll have to wait until Sunday, because I was just looking and I don't get into TV ratings because I don't understand them. And there's always context that needs to be applied.
They're not good though, Sunday, Rex. They're not good.
They're not good. And they were down, I think, 30% on Sunday at Bay Hill. And that was Scottie Scheffler. That was the world number one. Like, that's as good as the tour can possibly do. Now, it was a runaway, which, okay, that kind of bites into it a little bit. And I had someone sort of explain to me, if you look at everything else that was around it on that particular Sunday, there was a lot of college basketball, I guess, around it, both men's and women's, that were sort of eating into that audience. And so you do have to always kind of look at it with a little bit of a grain of salt. Well, no, on Monday morning, like, did it resonate? Do the fans still believe? And this goes to what I wanted to transition to here, because you're going to write. Are you ever going to finish your column?
Probably not. At this point, I'm just going to save it for maybe the tour championship. Just keep holstering this for the next 5 months.
Because at this point, it goes to, and I tend to agree with what Rory said this morning, and you asked him a really pointed question about how, like, you, how many times did Jay Monahan say, refer to the fans?
24.
And 24 times.
Referred to 57 fans. Minutes.
It was clearly a talking point. And look, I think there is a lot of fatigue among the golfing public. They're tired of hearing about deals and Live Golf and money and separation and path back and all of the things that we sort of get mired into. We're 24 minutes in and we've already sort of ran through all the things we've done. It. I think people are tired of hearing about that, and it's starting to eat into the popularity that is golf. And I did find it interesting that the commissioner kept referencing the idea that golf is as popular now as it ever has been. And this is born from the pandemic, and sort of that growth and that popularity has grown. I remember back in the day when everyone was saying how successful and popular the PGA Tour was, and, oh, golf's in a great spot. Well, no, golf wasn't in a great spot there. They're actually losing numbers every year. The recreational
The Tiger boom recreationally never happened. The boom occurred on the PGA Tour with prize money absolutely skyrocketing.
And I remember vividly even being here, and tour officials would be like, you know, you're conflating the issue. Like, it's not PGA Tour golf that's an issue. We're successful. We're doing really well. It's the recreational game. Well, now it's kind of flipped, and the recreational game is growing. But yeah, I think they've become sort of numb to the idea of, I don't want to tune in and hear that someone's going to win $4 million on Sunday at Bay Hill. That's not what I'm interested in. Like, I want to see the best players in the world competing against each other. When we don't have it now, and it's clear we're not going to have it anytime soon.
Yeah, I think when Jay Monahan was talking, and he's talking about re-engaging the fans in new and interesting ways, as certainly as you look forward to the PGA Tour enterprises and what they can bring, whether it's new innovations on the TV side, more data, more insights, whether it's sort of the on-site experience for fans and what that could entail, as you said, kind of the Formula One experience. But Rory said, he called it low-hanging fruit, or the easiest way to re-engage the fans is to bring these tours together. The tours have been mortally wounded by what's happened over the past 2 years, where neither product is thriving in this current environment, and creating that pathway back as soon as possible should be a chief priority, not just for Jay Monahan, but the rest of the PGA Tour policy board as well. Again, the sense of urgency that Roy McIlroy feels is not necessarily the urgency with which these matters are proceeding. And I think that's frustrating for everybody involved.
Well, and just to add to that, not only do I feel like they're not close to any type of agreement, any type of pathway back, any kind of deal, any kind of deal with the public investment fund, I imagine a scenario like the buzz this week is that this could lead into the end of next year for a lot of different reasons. There's a lot of reasons why the PGA Tour would be inclined to drag their feet. Probably the primary one is some of those contracts, some of those big contracts with LIV. You're talking about Brooks, you're talking about Bryson, you're talking about DJ, you're probably talking about Phil. They all come due next year. And so if you would be motivated to drag your feet towards the end of next year and see if LIV Golf is willing to double down and pay those guys another deal to stick around for another 3 or 4 years to press.
Do you want to endure another year and a half of this nonstop cycle of will they or won't they? both products suffering in this current environment. That would be dreadful if this thing continues for another year and a half.
No one wants it. And this goes to what we were just talking about. I think the idea that the fan has had it, and you and I hear it enough. When I have friends who ask me on a Sunday, which event should I watch? That's a problem. I would say watch the PGA Tour. I feel like they still have the best product. Certainly if it's on NBC, I'm going to be motivated to have people tune in, but it's tough because maybe your favorite player was Bryson DeChambeau. Of course. So maybe you gravitate in that direction. It's not a good scene. And I think when I asked the commissioner, and I kind of had to double back with him just when we saw him point blank, is there a danger not doing a deal with LIV Golf? And he had to dance around the question. I think his line to me was, if we don't do a deal, we're right back to where we are right now. And that's not good for
us. Which is a very bad place. A place where the fans are fatigued, where players are frustrated, and both products are suffering at the exact same time. All right. That's going to do it for this edition of Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. You guys know the drill. Make sure to go to NBCSports.com/golf for the latest news and notes from the Players Championship. You can catch Rex for 90 seconds of bad television each and every night on live from typically towards the end of the show. Do not, folks, go to the first couple blocks. He's not going to appear. But if you want to see Rex, second to last block, maybe if they have
block
time.
Block nine of an 8-block show.
Keep it short, keep it tight, and make sure you get it back to the desk. Rex and I will be doing our usual song and dance, however, on the early live rums if you guys want to check that out as well. And just a reminder, we'll be back with mini pods each and every tournament round. We promise we'll keep it 15, 20, maybe 25 minutes if a situation warrants it for these mini pods. We'll get those up and uploaded as quickly as possible. Thank you guys, as always, for listening. Thank you for the support. We'll talk to you guys in 24 hours after the opening round of the Players Championship.